Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. And tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate Talk Radio AM 640. Speaking of cabins in the woods, that's where I'm heading after we dim the lights here in about 4 hours. Taking my boys a few hours north of Toronto to a cottage on Long Lake, and we're hoping to catch us some bass. I love to eat them. They're great fun to catch. There's nothing like trolling for smallmouth and then seeing one twirl and tail dance on the water after striking your bait. But here's the problem. The bass up in Long Lake really seem to go for leeches. Now, I'm fine baiting a hook with big juicy dew worms or crayfish, but leeches? Seriously? They're just gross. They're vile creatures. What is it Stephen Wright says? There's a fine line between fishing and standing at the end of a dock like an idiot. I can't wait. But then again, I can't wait to get to tonight's show. Before we get the oars in the water, however, I want to wish a very happy birthday to Coast fan, Zach Hunka, of Cold Lake, Alberta. Zach, I hope you had a good one. Lots of cake and ice cream, but not too many candles. Hope you didn't have to call the fire department or anything. I had a lot of fun sitting in the chair last night talking baseball and ghosts, and I enjoyed my conversation with UFO disclosure libertarian advocate Joseph Buckman. But also, of course, all of you who called in during the open line segment, and you rose to the occasion once again. And we have a great show on tap again tonight, this morning. But I can't promise it's going to be fun. Things are going to get kind of heavy, quite frankly, in the second half of the program when we talk about North America's opioid addiction and overdose epidemic. Opioids, of course, are a class of drugs that include the illicit drug heroin, as well as the illicit prescription pain reliever, oxycodone and hydrocodone and codeine and morphine and fentanyl and others. Of the 20.5 million Americans 12 or older that had a substance use disorder in 2015, 2 million had a substance use disorder involving prescription pain relievers, and 591,000 had a substance use disorder involving heroin. Drug overdose is the leading cause of accidental death in the U.S., with 47,055 legal drug overdoses in 2014. Opioid addiction is driving this epidemic, with 18,893 overdose deaths related to prescription pain relievers and 10,574 overdose deaths related to heroin in 2014. Get this, in 2012, 259 million prescriptions were written for opioids. 259 million in 2012. That's more than enough to give every American adult their own bottle of pills. And a recent study found that further revealed that while almost 85% of doctors screen for signs of prior narcotic painkiller abuse, just one-third ask about a family history of addiction. In the state of Maryland, heroin deaths have increased by 186% from 2010 to 2015. And over a two-year period, more Americans died of opiate addiction than died in the entire Vietnam War. So in hours 3 and 4, a board-certified pain physician, Dr. William Marone, sounds a passionate call to arms against this death storm sweeping across North America. He'll discuss how heroin and fentanyl are changing the landscape forever and why most doctors are ill-equipped and inaccurately trained to treat addiction and overdoses. Then, when many of us think about the Ark of the Covenant, the gold-covered wooden chest described in the book of Exodus containing the two stone tablets of the Ten Commandments, we think about Indiana Jones and the movie The Raiders of the Lost Ark. In the film, of course, Harrison Ford is in a race with a group of Nazis to find the Ark, and the Nazis are intent on harnessing the Ark's unimaginable power and control. However, when the Nazis finally open the Ark, we remember what happened, they're instantly vaporized. Well, my guest in the first 2 hours of tonight's transmission is considered a real-life Indiana Jones, Henry Moscoff, will join us live from Israel in just a few moments to tell us how much of the, or to tell us how much of the depiction of the Ark in Steven Spielberg's epic is accurate. He'll also tell us what the Ark was designed to do. Turns out it has several capabilities, not only as a weapon with awesome destructive power. The Ark also plays a pivotal role in biblical prophecy. In fact, he says all prophecy links to the Ark of the Covenant. Now, according to the Bible, Moses had the Ark of the Covenant built to hold the Ten Commandments at the command of God. The Israelites carried the Ark with them during their 40 years spent wandering in the desert. And after the conquest of Canaan, it was brought to Shiloh. King David later took the Ark to Jerusalem, where his son and successor Solomon eventually installed it in the temple. Since its disappearance some 2,000 years ago, numerous theories have arisen about its fate. One of the most well-known holds that Levitical priests moved the Ark to Egypt just before the Babylonians sacked Jerusalem in 586 BC. From there, it was supposedly moved to Ethiopia, where it resides to this day in the town of Aksum, in the St. Mary of Zion Cathedral. Well, tonight, Rabbi Moskov will tell us with great certainty the exact true location of the Ark of the Covenant. You know, we're always searching for truth here on Coast to Coast. We're always searching for solutions. As Thoreau said, many of us go fishing all our lives without realizing it's not fish that we're after. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. Why don't you stay a while? Harry Moskoff is an award-winning film producer and writer of The Ark Report. He's a Canadian-born research analyst. His intense interest in biblical archaeology and politics has now made him a prolific contributor to several Israeli publications and an internationally acclaimed expert on the Ark of the Covenant and other hidden temple artifacts. Harry's been working on this project for more than 25 years. Using his skills as a patent agent to research and dig deep beneath the surface of an issue to find the truth. From poring through multitudes of religious and secular texts, and he's concluded that the exact location of the Ark of the Covenant and how it may be accessed is no longer a mystery. Harry is managing director of an internationally accredited press organization, Moskov Media in Israel, that promotes issues concerning Israel with an emphasis on biblical archaeology. He's also an ordained Orthodox rabbi. Harry Moskov, welcome to Coast AM.
Thank you very much. Great to be here. It's in the morning over here. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here in Israel, so I just have my coffee. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, our pleasure, and thank you for joining us. Can you give us the physical description of the Ark as laid out in Exodus?
Well, sure. I'm actually looking at a copy that I have right here in my living room. And, it's a golden box, essentially a chest, about 4 feet long, 2.5 feet wide. And it's got two staves that stick out of it, and about another 3 feet on either end to be carried. It has a, on top of the box has two golden cherubim angels facing each other with their wings spread towards each other, and a little bit of a crown, I guess you could say, at the top of the box. Inside the box, of course, that's what it looks like, but the main purpose is to carry the two stone tablets, the Ten Commandments that God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai, amongst other things.
And we often hear about the mercy seat. Songs have been written about that. I think it was Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds wrote a song called The Mercy Seat. What is the mercy seat? What is its significance?
Well, the mercy seat is more of a modern, I won't say modern term, but it's definitely going all the way back to when it was first created about 3,300 years ago by Bezalel and Moses. The ark, the mercy seat specifically refers to the cover of the ark. You know, the cover that can be taken off, obviously, and then when you look inside, you can see the Ten Commandments, the stone tablets, etc. And on top of the mercy seat sits these angels, these cherubim.
And it was also designed, and we'll get into the technology underlying the Ark of the Covenant. But was it also designed as a way of God to communicate with Moses?
Sure. I think that that's one of the things, Richard, that most people don't realize. Something that I spoke about recently at the Prophecy of the News conference here in Jerusalem in Beit Shemesh, which is available, by the way, on the YouTube channel, etc. But basically, in that conference, I was one of the panelists, and it's true that the main function for the Ark is to house the stone tablets, as well as the scroll that Moses himself wrote of Deuteronomy. It also acted as a sort of a weapon of war, if you will, and it had a bunch of other different functions within the context of the Israelites moving through the desert, as you mentioned. But one of the lesser-known principles and uses for the Ark was as a medium for prophecy. That's right.
And when the Ark was carried through the desert by the staves, I mean, it's very specific, as I recall, the distance between the Jews as they were traveling through the Sinai Desert in search of the Holy Land, and the distance between them. They had to keep back, you know, from the Ark, something like 80 cubits or something. Why is that significant? Why is that significant?
Well, it's significant. That's a good question in a number of ways. First of all, the Ark itself had a bunch of other functions. One of them was to lead the way, to level the mountains, to there were beams of high energy, some say electrostatic energy, that came out, spiritual energy, essentially, like a holy fire coming out of the staves of the Ark that would help to level mountains. It says that it would kill the scorpions and the snakes from before the Israelites walking through the desert. And apparently, just yesterday, I was reading that some of these scorpions were the size of a bow, like of a bow and arrow. They were huge scorpions, and then they would see the carcasses and know that the Ark was the one that actually was able to clear the way and kill all these different huge rodents, etc., in the desert. So it traveled in front of the Jewish people, of the Israelites, up to a kilometer. Some say even more than a kilometer. Another reason why is because it's sort of compared to almost like a nuclear reactor. It was extremely powerful, indestructible, and the center and the attraction, it's like a magnet for God's presence, divine presence on earth. So it's something that was, as it still is today, extremely, you don't want to get close to it unless you have to. In fact, there are many stories that the Levites, you know, one of the 12 tribes, I'm actually a priest from the Levite tribe, and, you know, one of the reasons why the Levites were less in population, there were fewer in number than all the other tribes, is because the Ark had an effect, the effect of the Ark on the Levites, the Levites that surrounded it, that camped around the Ark, was that it made them pass away earlier. It had an effect, they weren't able to live a long life. It actually had an effect on their longevity.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that. There is the story, I believe, I'm not sure which book of the Old Testament, there was an Israelite named Uzzah. He lays his hands upon the Ark, and he's struck down by God. So what I've heard an engineer describe the Ark of the Covenant as a giant capacitor, and that perhaps the real cause of death of Uzzah was as 10,000 volts of static electricity.
Yes, that's actually, it depends on, there's a bunch of different ways of describing it, but that is a possibility that I refer to in my book. There is a possible scientific explanation as well for that type of thing happening, and I think that you said it pretty correctly. And there are many people that actually do refer over the years into the engineers that have looked at the way the Ark is constructed and said, yeah, this could be a supercapacitor conductor. One of the things that I mentioned is something, an invention, original invention called the Leyden jar. basically what it consists of is a glass jar coated outside and inside with tin foil, and it's sort of like a capacitor with two parallel plates, positive and negative, separated by a glass insulator and with a wooden lid. Now, basically, the center of that is a brass rod. If you look it up, it's called the Leyden jar, L-E-Y-D-A-N. But the way it's conducted is that it's the way it's sort of constructed is that as it's constructed as an insulated conductor, so that, you know, if you compare between the details of the arc and this jar, the Leyden jar, you get some interesting results. In other words, the gold coverings of the arc, let's say, according to this theory, form the positive inside and earth outside conductive layers, right? That represents the tinfoil lining. And the insulator separates the two layers, in this case, the inside wood of the arc. Basically, to make a long story short, without getting too technical, the arc could be actually considered as a conductor, like a charging rod. You know, the lid could be like a charging rod with the two fingers on top of its conductive lid, and there's a double configuration, and there's positive and negative terminals. So for sure, those principles do apply. I mean, it's a little bit more complex, but, you know, that it could actually generate electromagnetic power, and it could actually be supplied with electromagnetic power, recharged, as it were, which is a separate, very fascinating topic on its own, how the arc was sort of brimming over with this electromagnetic electricity. And like you said, Uzzah, who was trying to steady the arc on its way to Jerusalem, touched it and was definitely zapped. So there is a scientific explanation for that, too.
So that's the lesson of the arc, is look but don't touch. Rabbi Harry Moskov is with us, award-winning film producer and writer of The Ark Report, joining us live on the phone from Israel, where it's 8 o'clock in the morning there.
Right.
Now, the Ark could also, I mean, had awesome destructive powers. You didn't have to just get up close and touch it. I mean, Joshua, there's the story of Joshua in the Battle of Jericho. Of course, he's sounding the horns and the walls come tumbling down, but I'm wondering, was it the horns or was it the ark? Didn't he carry the ark into that battle, and was that responsible for the walls come tumbling down?
Well, I would say the ark is even more responsible than the shofar, than the trumpets being blown. And I mean, both were commanded by God to be done, to encircle Jericho seven times, and, you know, they were huge walls back then, and with gigantic people, giants, living inside. So we know that it was not easy. There's no natural way that the Israelites could really penetrate those walls. But the ark itself was carried by four priests, and one in the front, and blowing a shofar, blowing a ram's horn. And it was a very specific way that the Israelites were commanded to go about with doing that, sort of like a parade in a way, around the sort of a war parade, a war march, I guess you could say, around Jericho. But the Ark definitely had something to do with it, a huge part to play in that, yeah.
So we're coming up on a break here, and we can start the conversation now, and then we can continue after if necessary, if we don't get the full answer here. But if the Ark had such awesome destructive power, how is it then that, you know, Jerusalem was sacked by the Babylonians? I mean, why couldn't they just have pulled that ark out and had King Nebuchadnezzar just trembling in his boots?
Good question. A lot of it has to do, I write about this too in my book, in the Ark Report, and many have asked, many of the sages over, you know, hundreds of centuries have asked that question as well. And I think that apparently what it has to do with is the spiritual status of not only the Jewish people, but the where people were holding spiritually at that time. In other words, at the beginning of King Solomon's temple, everybody, the Jewish people and the whole world really, was on a very high spiritual level in general. Everybody was very well connected to a higher being, a spiritual source. There was idolatry, but you know, people knew at the same time that there is something that's a higher being, a God, a supreme power. And that was all, and you can see that when you go to the temple in Jerusalem, you can see the cloud resting on top of the temple building. And you can see
Rabbi Moskov, I'm going to have to interject. Excuse the interruption, but we'll pick this up on the other side. Here's Thunderclap Newman taking us into the break with Something in the Air right here on Coast to Coast AM. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T, sending little Memphis Soul your way. That's Otis and Love Man. That was actually recorded in 1967, but wasn't released until 2 years after his death. He had recorded so much material that even after he died, every year there was another album coming out. This was his fourth posthumous album called Love Man. Check this out. In India, there's a panic about an alleged entity that's cutting the hair of unwitting women. This is happening in Indian villages, and it's continuing. Incident reports are starting to accumulate. It's getting increasingly stranger. Authorities say that an astounding 15 cases have been reported over the last 2 weeks, which brings the total to a whopping 23 such incidents said to have occurred since the panic began earlier in June. The most recent victim described her ordeal to the Press Trust of India, telling the outlet that a thin man in a red and yellow outfit appeared at her doorstep while carrying a trident. After the woman told the man to leave, he seemingly complied with her request, only to return and somehow rendered her unconscious. When she awoke, the woman says she found herself lying on the floor and her braid had been chopped off. So there you go. Some ghost barber, perhaps? Not sure. Hey, thanks to George Norrie, finally we have a dating site to find others with similar interests, ParanormalDate.com. It helps you find a match. It shares your interests in the paranormal, ghosts, life after death, the Ark of the Covenant, UFOs, alternative science, Bigfoot. It's free to search and send messages. There are thousands of members in your area, and ParanormalDate.com is now optimized for dating on your cell phone. It's free to sign up. You can use the code word George to stay. ParanormalDate.com. Remember, you are not alone. When we come back, more of my conversation with Rabbi Harry Moskov as we discuss the Ark of the Covenant, and we'll find out why the Ark, with all its awesome destructive power, was unable to protect the Israelites from the ravaging Babylonians. Back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Rabbi Harry Moskov is with us live from Israel, and we're talking about the Ark of the Covenant. Before the break, Rabbi, I was asking you about why the Ark, with all its awesome destructive power, was unable to prevent the Babylonians from sacking Jerusalem in 586 B.C.
Well, the truth is it was able, but it wasn't really allowed, so to speak, to do that function, because at the end of the day, the Ark of the Covenant is really a tool in the hands of its creator, in the hands of God, in other words. God is the one that really decides when it's going to be revealed and when it's going to be hidden. And what happened in that case was the spiritual level, as I was saying, of the Jewish people at the time definitely was falling towards the end of the 410 years of the King Solomon's temple of that period. There was a lot of idolatry actually started to gain, and adultery and all kinds of, things that were happening in society. And the 10 tribes were also dispersed. The kingdom of Israel was no longer intact. So all these things played a factor in the destruction by Nebuchadnezzar, as you mentioned, and the Babylonians of the first temple. So, it's actually interesting because about 20 years or so, most people don't realize this, but there's a story, a fact actually mentioned in the Talmud, telling that about 10, 20 years before the destruction by the Babylonians of the temple, our neighbors back then, which is the Moabites, which is located in today's Jordan, in that area, they actually came into Israel and broke into the temple, broke into the Holy of Holies section, and found the Ark and found the cherubim, the angels, embracing each other in a very sort of sensual way, almost erotic way. This is what it says. They took out the Holy Ark and they paraded it through the streets, showing what they thought an almost repugnantly sensual artifact, which was the root of Judaism. They were saying, look, here is your most holy artifact in Judaism, and look what the angels are doing. Look, you know, they're trying to discredit the holiness of the Jewish people, etc. Anyway, the king at that time, Hoshea, Yeshayahu, captured it back from them shortly afterwards, brought it back into the temple, hid it underground directly beneath the Holy of Holies, where it remains to this day in the Temple Mount. I can talk to you more about that.
You're disclosing the location. You are disclosing the location. You're saying, we need to back up a moment because we might as well get into this now. Because the Ark of the Covenant disappears from history in 586. Some have claimed that Nebuchadnezzar took it. Some have claimed that the Levitical priests moved the Ark to Egypt just before the Babylonians sacked Jerusalem. Some have said that it was moved to Ethiopia from Egypt, where it resides to this day in St. Mary of Zion in Ethiopia, in Aksum. But you're saying, you're telling us tonight on Coast to Coast AM that the Ark of the Covenant is exactly where it was left over 2,000 years ago.
That's correct. I just want, and I'll tell you why in a moment, just to put closure on the story very briefly. The reason why, people say, and it says over there, you know, a lot of people read that passage in the Talmud and say, why were the angels hugging each other at the destruction of the temple when the Jewish people, and they were doing the will of God? And it's to show that, yeah, even through the long exile over 2,000 years, when we don't have the Ark in its revealed state, the way we did, still there's hope, and you know, you see miraculously today the return to Israel, etc., and that there's that love is still there. But, you know, one of the things that you mentioned about the Ark itself being under the Temple Mount, in order for, like, doesn't say, you know, when the Second Temple was built, when the Herodian Temple was built, this is 2,000 years ago, about 2,500 years ago, so the Ark was not there. It was hidden, like we said before, by King Yeshayahu. It was sent down directly underneath, as I write in my book. It was lowered down underneath, close to where the Dome of the Rock is today, about four levels down, and I prove it, you know, in many different ways, how it actually got there. And it stayed there. And during the Second Temple period, it was not the room, the Holy of Holies, was actually empty. There was nothing in there. The Ark was actually in its off-site status, as they say, below. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar didn't take it. He did take it. There is a list of items that are written that he did take. That the Ark is not listed there. And then when, 70 years later, when the Jewish people came back to rebuild the temple with Ezra and Nehemiah, etc. So at that point, Cyrus doesn't list the Ark as being one of the items that were given back with the other, with the menorah, with the candelabra, etc. You mentioned also, you know, the common, there's very many theories, but one of the most common ones is Ethiopia, that King Solomon sent a gift, as it were, to the Queen of Sheba, and it went back to Aksum. Now, I do believe, upon the research that I did do, that there is something in Aksum. There were replicas, actually. Each one of the vessels of the temple had a replica.
A decoy. A decoy, perhaps.
The Ark is there, but it's a replica. It's not the real thing. It doesn't have the stone tablets inside. But there is a replica there, and there are some others that have gone, some other theories about the Knights Templar, and about the Crusaders that were on the Temple Mount as well during the Middle Ages, and what happened over there, and how things got to where they did. But the Ark itself has been in the same place for over 2,700 years, almost directly beneath the Dome of the Rock, a little further towards the Western Wall, actually, to the south, about 15 to 20 meters below the surface.
And why is it then that when it was moved there to protect it from the invading Babylonians, when the Jews returned to Jerusalem and rebuilt Jerusalem under King Cyrus, Why is it that they did they not know where it was? Did they not could they not have gone down below and placed it back in the second temple in the Holy of Holies?
I think that, well, that's the truth is nobody really knows the answer to that question. I don't know the answer to that question, to be honest. I'm not going to pretend, that I know all the answers. That's something that begs to be asked. We think that they really did look for it. Upon building the second temple again and returning of the exiles, I think that certainly they would have looked for it. But they realized, I think, through prophetic inspiration, that the Jewish people or the world was still not on a level that could handle the power of the Ark of the Covenant, the divine presence on the earth as it was in the times of King Solomon. Even though there was a resurgence of spirituality, etc., converging on Jerusalem, nevertheless, when the Ark was in its revealed state, and I'm sure you'll get into this after, there were over 1 million prophets, in the First Temple of Jerusalem area in the world, personal people having personal prophecies about their own life. And then in the Second Temple period, where the Ark was not in its revealed, when it was underground in a hidden chamber where it is today, there were all prophecy on that level. There are many different levels, but on that high level, stopped. So I think that they did look for it, but there's an incredible story in the Talmud where one of the priests, one of the Kohanim, it's called, and one of the priests was working in the temple, and there was a loose tile in the floor in one of the rooms, in the chamber of the wood, it's called. He was working on the logs to go on the sacrificial altar, and he noticed a loose tile. And when he picked up the tile with his hammer, a holy fire came out. It was a true story. Before he could actually say, because he realized he had come upon the tunnel that leads to where the Ark of the Covenant is buried. But before he could actually shout it out and say, "Look what I found, this is a tunnel," so he was consumed by the same type of holy fire. And that was that. That was a sign that no, the Ark is not supposed to be found in the Second Temple.
Ah, fascinating. And then during the Crusades, when the Knights Templars, of course, the Second Temple is destroyed in AD 70 by the Romans, but the Knights Templar were all over those ruins, supposedly. Why weren't they able to find it? Is it possible that the Ark would be invisible to those who weren't supposed to see it?
Well, there were for sure paranormal properties about the Ark. I mean, it could levitate. I mean, it weighed 4 tons. It was all gold, and so it helped when it did travel. It traveled with 4 priests. It could levitate, and the angels turned their heads, like we mentioned before, on top of the mercy seat. So there were definitely properties that were, supernatural, of course. Being invisible, it did have the property of, it says in the Talmud that you couldn't measure it. It was both in this world and the next world. In other words, in the chamber itself of the Holy of Holies, which is 20 cubits wide, you could take it, you could measure from one end of the box of the ark to the other, to the wall, and the other one to the wall, the other side to the wall, and you would get 10 and 10. In other words, it took up no space. It's a fact that it actually took up no space. If you were to take a measuring rod, you would see that there's nothing there, and yet you could see it and you could touch it. So it was really the matrix between the next world, a totally spiritual world, and this world. It's the meeting point, as it still is today. So there is that element of the fact that it knows, it's aware of its surroundings. Some say that it actually was an angel called Oriel that lived inside the ark. And, so as you see in the Raiders of the Lost Ark, that part was right. When they took off the ark cover and you see these angels coming out, that sort of was an interesting, the way that that was portrayed. It was actually, pretty close in a way, according to the Bible. But it did have an awareness of its surroundings, if a person had permission to be there or not be there, and it would take action, deadly action or otherwise. So It might have been sort of invisible like that, but I think that the real answer to your question about the Knights Templar, Richard, is that they were looking for the, and I put this in my book, and I think it's fascinating, they were actually looking for the wrong thing. It's true, they were on the Temple Mount, and they went down into the caverns, but they were looking for a golden chest with rods. What they should have been looking for was a room, because it was lower down on the original tiles that it stood on in the King Solomon's temple, golden tiles. And it was set up in a room that was actually made for it at the very beginning by King Solomon, you know, to be off-site. You know, there's two chambers. There's a revealed one on top in the Holy of Holies, and then there's one underneath. But it was originally set there to be there when it was moved at the end of the, just before the destruction. So it's actually in a room. But they may have actually gone to a wall. And right behind that wall is the ark itself, and they wouldn't have known it. They would have just seen a wall, you know, underground. So you really have to know that you're looking for a chamber. And then once you find that chamber and the tunnels that lead up to it, which I actually have in my book as well, then you can go and see how to get into the chamber. So it could be they were really very, very close, but close but no cigar.
How were you able to determine with such certainty, Rabbi, that the Ark is where it is, beneath the Temple Mount?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, I use mostly sources from biblical sources, mostly Jewish, Talmud, the Torah, you know, the Old Testament, places that, you know, so I have a whole bunch of, I've been able to go further than anybody that I know of anyway before me, although I'm thankful to them. They definitely broke the ice. Many good people. Some have been on your show, and they're great. They've done some great research. But I've been able to go further and say, oh, you know what? It's basically through deduction. If a temple stood here, then it turns out the ark would have to be exactly below, judging on the surface that was back then, the ground surface of the Temple Mount 2,000 years ago. I use archaeology, I use different experiments through the Western Wall Tunnel that have been conducted, sonar experiments, electromagnetic experiments of what's on the other side of the Western Wall when you go down that deep. There's a cavern in one place. It's very interesting. There's a lot of proof to the theory. And there's where the water used to go down to the temple area. Basically, all these things, there's a lot of archaeological proofs, there's a lot of topographical proofs, the way that Mount Moriah, which is the way it was called back then, the original topography of the mount before Herod actually expanded it, the way it was in King Solomon's days, what it looked like. All these things are factors, historical factors and religious factors, the way the temple itself was built, had to mean that the Dome of the rock where it is today, for instance, with the Dome of the Rock, that the temples couldn't have been there. It had to have been removed further to the south, and then you have to go straight down below that point, about four or five levels. And Maimonides also talks about that, the Rambam. It's not just my opinion. I'm actually basing it off some real sources.
But to excavate or to confirm that it's there, to find it, to tunnel under the Temple Mount, that's going to set off a big problem.
World War III.
Because the Temple Mount, is it not controlled by the Palestinian Authority?
Yeah, it's controlled by the Jordanian Waqf on a daily level. Israel has sovereignty since 67, although to be honest, nowadays it wouldn't seem like it, but okay. Bottom line is that the Waqf does have daily, authority over it, and it's definitely illegal. And this is a research, strictly academic research project. You know, I don't tell people. I just did a big lecture yesterday, a successful lecture here in Israel, and many people asked me about that. So listen, you know, it looks like you know where it is, and you know where the tunnel entrances are. There's about 45 tunnels that we know of in the Temple Mount itself. And I list about four or five entrances which would be possible to get in down there. There's something called the Well of the Souls, a cave that's underneath the Dome of the Rock, and there's cistern number 3 down there. And there's some other entrances on the south side where this where the archaeological excavations are, the Ophel is called. Some amazing tunnels there that it really is possible to go in. Of course, it's illegal, so I would not do that personally.
All right, Harry, I got to stop you there. I got to jump in here. We're going to head into a break. We'll continue this conversation on the other side. The Ark of the Covenant. How is it linked to prophecy? We'll discuss. Here's The Marmalade, Reflections of My Life, taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.